Well, let's have Brother David Peach come. He's going to teach us something about smart computing. So, while he's coming, I will say this. We are very blessed to have David here as a tech guy. Okay, as a geek. Here, he's our bio geek. And he works wonders with the good things around here. Thankful for that. David Peach, and whatever time you take
it here. What do you mean by the word wonder? I don't know how to interpret that.
Sometimes we wonder.
Yes. Yes. Wonder. Well, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I feel like I'm a little hot. Can you go turn down one of those? Actually, the one on the third from the right, all the way over to the right, the slider third from the right. And pull it down just a little bit. Yeah, there we go. 1, 2, 3, 4. That sounds good. All right. Thank you. Oh, that's still a little hot if I look down. Maybe turn the podium mic down. Okay. All right. Well, we're going to talk about computers. And really, this is kind of an advertisement type session. We have a module, a smart module that we do that's about computing. And it is just this, we call it the essentials of smart computing. And it is various topics and things of what you need to do if you have a new computer, if you're transitioning from one computer to another, some basic things that you should have in place. And this is about a six-hour module. And what I'm going to do today is just kind of give you some of the highlights of the things that we do in that. And so I am going to try to actually complete thoughts here. It's not like this is just snippets of the whole thing. This will be completed thoughts. However, there's so much more that we do in that smart training. So if you would like to do a smart training class with Brother Terry on one of these topics that we do have the smart modules in, then get with him. We don't mind doing this for a family. It's great if we can do it for 15 missionaries all at once. That's fine. That's wonderful. But if it is a family that wants to come and we can spend some time with you and helping you with some specific practical things, then that's what we'd like to do with the smart training. One of the things that we're not going to get into deeply today is backing up. When we do this, as a smart module, we have you bring your computer and a backup hard drive, and we actually sit down and work through how to set up backups and taking care of your stuff and making sure you're not losing pictures. And yeah, we've all heard horror stories. You don't have to admit that if this has happened to you, but we've all heard horror stories of I lost all of my kids' baby pictures. That didn't happen with our parents unless the house burned down. But it certainly happens with our generation, where we have a lot of the pictures that are digital pictures, and they're on a hard drive that dies, or the computer gets stolen or whatever, and we have no backups for it. And so we need to be getting backups of our stuff. Now, there are various ways to back stuff up, and there are better ways than others to back things up. I want to encourage you to just do it, whether it's the best way, the perfect way, or not. Just somehow get your stuff into some other format other than your main hard drive. Now, when we talk about backups, the right way to do it, 3-2-1 is what we call it. Three forms of media. So you have it on the original hard drive, and then three copies. You have it on the original hard drive. You have it somewhere else. And you have maybe like another hard drive, or you have it on a CD, or you have it on a cloud backup. But you have three backups of everything, three copies of everything. And then you have it on at least two different medium. So that's the two of 3, 2, 1. Two different medium, meaning a hard drive and an optical backup, or a hard drive and online backup. Some way that if your hard drive dies, and the only way you can read that is, or let's say your computer dies, well, the only way you can get to it is having another hard drive in there. You want it in two different formats, just so that you have a variety of ways to be able to get it back. And then at least one off-site backup. So that's the one. So three different copies, two different medium, one off-site. And the off-site backup, meaning it could be online. It could be something like Carbonite. We use Backblaze here at the office. It could be Amazon Web Services, AWS. They have different backup options. But there are various ways to do that. Or it could just be a hard drive that lives at your mother's house, so that it's not physically present where you are. If your house burned down, and yes, I have all my backups, but they're in the same bedroom where the computer lives. Well, the computer burnt, and so did all your backups. So that didn't give you much security there. So you need at least one offsite. And again, that doesn't have to be necessarily online if you're scared of online backups, but it needs to be somewhere other than where you physically are. So that's the 3-2-1 idea of backups. Windows has a automatic backup option if you have an external drive. The way we do it here at the office is we have a network hard drive that all the computers, every so often, they just make a copy of their whole system right into that drive. Now I have lots and lots of storage on that network drive, so I'm able to actually, I just take a snapshot of the whole computer. But you don't need to do that. You just need your data, your pictures, your documents. So we'll talk about some of those things of specifically what you want to back up. But you can set up Windows so it just does it automatically. I'm sure Mac has the same thing where you can go through and set up and say, okay, I want it to back up to this network drive, and it could be just a hard drive that you plug into it. Like every Sunday night at, or Monday morning at 2:00 in the morning. So Sunday night before you go to bed, you plug in your external hard drive, and Monday morning you wake up and everything's been backed up. So you've got an extra copy of something. But set up some form of backup to save your stuff, because hard drives are much better today than they were a few years ago, but they're still not perfect. And if you don't have a backup, then I can't help you. I can't restore something that is physically broken. Now, there are some places that can, for a little bit of money. You can have them actually rebuild your hard drive and pull the data off of it. You're in the tens of thousands of dollars to do that kind of thing. If you just have a $70 external hard drive that you're backing up to every so often, when your main hard drive dies, then you're ready to go. You don't have to spend the 10 grand to have it restored. So do the backups. If you can get if you can do an offsite backup, Carbonite. Carbonite's pretty cheap for a individual user. It's not so great for a business like we are. It would cost us $70 a month to do backup with Carbonite here. So we do a different option. But Carbonite is super easy for an individual user, and it's not that expensive. And there are many other backup options. But back your stuff up. We you've probably read the same type of missionary letter we have. Like, well, I haven't been able to write sooner because my computer died and all of my pictures on there and everything else, we've lost everything. And so now I'm sending out this prayer letter late and stuff. I'm sorry that that happened, but it shouldn't. Even if a computer completely dies and you have backups, you can restore stuff. You can go to the library. Now, I realize not every place has great libraries like we do here. I was in some libraries in Sicily, and I got a picture of the entire book collection of the library. Nice library, nice building, built in the year 500, but there weren't a whole lot of books there. So I got a picture of their whole collection. But I realize not every place has good libraries like we have here. But there are public computers that are available to you to be able to get that prayer letter out. And you don't have to be at the mercy of one dead hard drive. And hard drives do die. And so back your stuff up. Be vigilant about it. Do it more often than you think you need to, because you're probably still not doing it often enough. And just want to encourage you to work on getting your backups. Now, what kind of stuff do you need to back up? Your pictures, obviously. Let me just go through what you would do in Windows, since that's the more common operating system. But the My Documents folder inside of Windows, the My Pictures folder, the My Music folder, My Videos, those are just kind of standard folders on your Windows machine. You might also want to back up your desktop. Your desktop is usually where we end up putting shortcuts or very common files, and sometimes they don't live anywhere else. So back up your desktop. And then your downloads folder. You may or may not need to back that up. In my case, I tend to put stuff in my downloads folder that I can go download again. So that may or may not need to be backed up for you. But if all of the programs that you need to get your computer back going again and you don't have internet access, then it would be nice to have your downloads folder. So those are things you'd look up. In your in Mac, if you are using Mac, you want to back up your home folder. And you can find that if you go into the Finder and then do a search for, I think it's Go. That's a place. You go to Go and then tell it Home. Go Home. And then that whole folder, that's everything that pertains to you and your user. So that's the stuff you'd want to back up on there. That's if you're doing a manual backup. If you're doing an automatic backup, it's gonna find all of that stuff for you. But if you're going to transition to a new computer, maybe you get a new computer, it's like, okay, how do I get my stuff off of this to there? There are a variety of ways to do that, depending on which version of the operating system you're moving from to where you're going. On Mac, it's super easy. They have a It walks you through it. Is this your first time to have a Mac? Yes or no? If it's not and you have an older Mac, then it says, okay, this is how you plug them together and we'll take care of transferring all the information over it. It's a wonderful deal. Windows is a little more complicated depending on which version of Windows you're going from and to. But then they also have it so that you can pull your info from Windows to Mac. But that's some of the stuff that you would manually pull over. My documents, my pictures, my music, videos, that kind of thing. If you are moving to a new computer, you probably have bookmarks and saved stuff in your browser. If you are using if you're using a good browser, anything other than a Microsoft browser, then then there's an easy way to get all of this to happen. In Chrome, you can log into your Google account. And you probably have a Google account by now. Used to, if you had a Gmail account, then that meant you also had all these other things. If you have an Android phone, then you probably have a Google account. So anything that's tied to a Google account, if you log into your Chrome browser using your Google account, you can say, I want to be able to transfer this to any other computer. And so then when you pull up Chrome in another computer and log in, it sucks all that information over. So all of your bookmarks and settings and stuff will get transitioned over to the new place. Firefox has the same thing. Firefox, you can log into it, set up an account on one computer, log into it on the other computer, and it'll pull it right over. I have not played with Edge, which is the new Microsoft version of Internet Explorer. Internet Explorer did not have that easily done, but Edge may. I don't know. Okay, let's see. Jumping through here. Oh, here are some backup options. Carbonite, $60 a year per computer. Now, this was a year ago. I did the research on this, but it was $60 a year per computer. If you want to add extra computers, like add an external hard drive, then that's going to cost you considerably more. Just having one computer and one extra hard drive is going to cost $100 a year. So that goes up more than 50% just to add an external hard drive. If you have multiple computers in the house, then that's going to cost you way too much. CrashPlan has made some changes recently, but they're still a good option. $60 a year per computer, but for a whole family, 10 computers, it's only $150 a year. So for twice as much, you can back up 10 times the number of computers. Backblaze, which is what we use here at the office, is $50 a year per computer. And if you have three of them, it's $50 per three, so that you don't get a family discount there. Encryption. I think we've probably all heard the term encryption, particularly as it pertains to websites, going to a website, making sure it's an encrypted website and all of that. But your phone, your computers, they're probably offering now for you to encrypt your hard drive. That is something that can keep your data safe. It's great. The downside of encryption, and I'm just giving this as a thought experiment. The downside of encryption is, if something goes wrong with that installation of Windows or Mac OS, if something goes wrong with that installation and you no longer have the decrypting software on that hard drive, you can't just take that hard drive to another computer, plug it in, and get your data off, because that is encrypted with information in that installation of Windows. I have people bring computers to me that'll say, the computer died, the hard drive's fine, but the computer died and I want to get the data off. Okay, as long as the drive's not encrypted, I can get the data off of there and get it back to them. But if it's an encrypted drive, then that makes it more difficult for me. I can't as easily get in there and get that information. So I don't encrypt my hard drives. I'm able to pull my hard drive out, stick it in another computer, and still get the data off of it. I'm not saying that nobody should ever encrypt their hard drives, but just as a word of warning, if you encrypt a hard drive, it makes it so much harder to get data off of there. It also makes it impossible for the bad guy that stole your computer to get data off of there. So that's a good thing. If I steal your computer and it's not encrypted, maybe I don't have the password to get into Windows, but I can still pull your drive out, stick it in my computer, as an external drive, and I can get all your data off of there. So there's the downside to not encrypting. If I steal your computer, I can get all of the data, even though I can't get into Windows, which is not a true statement because I have tools to crack Windows passwords. I do it all the time for people. Bring me a computer and say, well, I forgot my password. Okay, give me 30 minutes and I'll get your password for you. But if that hard drive is encrypted, I can't get that password. I don't have the ability to do that. Encryption is great because it stops the bad guys from stealing your computer and getting at your data. But it also stops you from being able to get data off of a drive where maybe the hardware otherwise died. Something happened to the computer itself. Hard drive's fine, but I can't get to your data because it's encrypted with something. So that's something that you'll have to decide on yourself. Yes, sir. I think you're talking about online backups, like it depends on how you do it. But online backups, let's talk about that first. If I send my stuff to Carbonite, it theoretically gets encrypted here before I send it to them, so that then when they send it back to me, I decrypt it on my end. Now, I say theoretically because they do it in a way I can't actually see what's going on. What we use here is Backblaze. I encrypt it. I actually go through multiple steps. I encrypt it, and then they encrypt it and upload it to their servers. So when it comes back to me, they send it back to me, and it gets decrypted through their software, and then I have to decrypt it again a second time. So you can encrypt it, whether it's encrypted on this end or not, as far as our day-to-day use, it gets encrypted before it gets sent to them. Now, if I were to stick it on just a USB hard drive, it's not necessarily encrypted. That USB hard drive, if it's encrypted, then it can be sent over, or then when it goes over there, it's encrypted. You could also encrypt it before you send it over there, so it's a different deal. But no, it's not necessarily encrypted when it goes into an external storage. But the online stuff, they always encrypt it because of it going online. And I want this to be practical, so if you have questions, that's certainly fine to ask. You may not know the answer. Let's talk about computer security, since we're got here with this. If I have physical access to your computer's not secure. If it's not physically secure, it's not secure. If I have physical access to your computer, then I can crack your Windows password. I can get into your information. So you need to think about, yes, having a passcode on your phone is great, but if I can steal your phone, then I can potentially have the time to crack the password. Now, I don't have the skills to do that, but just about anything with a computer, I've got tools. There are tools available to get at your stuff. So your computer also needs to be physically secure. It's not just secured with a password, but it needs to be physically secured. So think about that when you're traveling. I'm amazed, I'm shocked as to how often, particularly here in the U.S., that I'll see people walk away from their computer that's just sitting there, open and logged in. Now, that doesn't happen in Italy or other places. South America, you'd never see that. But people don't think about that physical security thing. Okay, maybe it's not logged in. Maybe it's turned off. But if I can get your computer, then I can get your information. So think about the physical security of your machines as well. Yes?
Do you see where I'm going with this question? How they're getting in to know and then be able to get my information, and then later on you might see transactions for something that you never initiated.
Right. Excellent question. We're talking about open Wi-Fi. For example, if you go to McDonald's and you log into their Wi-Fi. Now they have a page that you go to and you say, I agree to obeying your rules and everything, but that's not securing your connection to them in any way. You are on a network, and at that point you're on McDonald's network. So let's say this is their modem router combination that goes out to the internet. Well, John connects to this, and Richard connects to this, and I connect to this. Everybody's connecting to this one box. If my connection to that box is not secure, then everybody on the network can see everybody else on the network. And therefore, when you go to this box and then out from there to get your connection, then I can see that. Now, once you connect to your bank, your connection to the bank is secure. But I, as somebody sitting in McDonald's, I can see that you went to your bank. I can see what you're connecting to because I'm on the same network. It's called traffic packet sniffing. I can sniff your connection, and I can see what you're sending back and forth. Now, with your bank, theoretically, they have a secure connection. They have HTTPS, which is a secure connection. So once you make that connection to the bank, any traffic that flows back and forth, I can't see. I can't see you're actually handing them your password and being able to all that traffic back and forth there. I cannot see that, but not all banks were always with a security certificate. It wasn't always the case where that was a closed connection. So when you're connecting to McDonald's box, you can see other people inside of that network. That is one of the ways that it can be set up. So you can see other folks and what they're doing. So that's why it's not safe. Now, they may do something. I don't know that they can. Here at Bio, when you connect to our Wi-Fi and you log in, we have a thing set up. First of all, you're connecting with a password. Therefore, that secures your connection to our router. So then I can see that you're connected, but I can't see what you're passing back and forth to the router. But beyond that, we've done what's called network isolation here, so that I can't even actually see what other devices are on the network. That's why you couldn't get to your folder this morning, because you were on our regular network, which is isolated, means that you can't see anybody else. So we give you some protection there. It also protects us. You can't see our network. All you can see is the internet whenever you're connected to the Bio Wi-Fi. So there are ways. McDonald's may have network isolation going, but I don't think that's possible with an open Wi-Fi connection. So you There are ways around that, so that you can safely and securely browse at McDonald's. There are ways to do that. But just be aware, everybody else that's connected to that box can see you and can possibly see the connections, at least up to this box. They may not be able to see your connection to your bank. So... I'll get to that in just a second. What was your question? Okay. All right. Yes.
I have one more comment that I've seen, and I don't quite understand, but I recognize it as a potential threat, is false McDonald's Wi-Fi signals. The guy sits over there, and he basically passes you through the internet, but you're not connected to McDonald's.
Right. And that's where the biggest fear is. Maybe we can buy one. You've seen the Wi-Fi pineapple? Oh, we'll have to work on that. There is a device that you can actually just buy. You walk into McDonald's or Starbucks, and what you do is you kick everybody off their network. It's a way to send a kind of a blast to knock everybody off their network. But then your device is sitting there, and it says, "Hey, I'm McDonald's." And so then you connect to the McDonald's network, everybody connects to your network, and then everything that goes through your little Wi-Fi pineapple, your device. And so that is one of those things that can happen. I don't live in fear of that, though I did it here once in a training school. I did a thing where I was capturing everybody's traffic, and then at the end of the week I said, okay, you connected to Skype on such and such day and you were doing this, but I wasn't actually looking at your passwords or anything. But it's possible. So now, what do I do? I do a couple different things. One, if I'm at McDonald's and I'm doing a Google search for some information because I'm just doing some research, I don't worry about it. I just let, if anybody wants to see that I'm looking up AK-47s and how they're made, I let them see it. I'm not real concerned about that. I don't do any banking when I'm connected to McDonald's Wi-Fi. I try not to log into anything that I shouldn't. However, that being said, I do check my email, and your email is very precious information. That is something that you want to protect. The most important password you have is not your bank's password, it's not your Facebook password, it's your email password. Because if I can get access to your email, I can reset your bank password. I can reset any other password by having access to your email. So your email is the most important password you have. So while I say I don't do anything secure, I do check my email. And so, again, one of those things where I don't really live in fear of this. But this is what I do, and this is what I recommend. When I am going to be checking my bank or whatever, I have a VPN, a virtual private network, and that is, I log into the VPN, and then that VPN, I go out to the internet from there. So I connect to McDonald's. McDonald's connects me to this other service, this VPN. Now my connection, even if they're seeing what comes through the McDonald's network, even if they see my connection from the VPN to me, they can't see what's going from outside of the VPN to the VPN to me. So then I can check my email from there, or my bank or whatever. So a VPN is the answer. I've got another session that will talk about computing stuff, and I may be able to get very specific details for you on a VPN. But there are various VPN services. Some of them are free. I avoid the free ones because you don't know what it is they're doing. That I don't mean to scare you, but Comcast is our charter. Who's our charter? Charter is our network provider here, our internet provider here. There's nothing to stop them from looking at every one of your pieces of content that comes and goes. There's nothing to stop them from being a man in the middle. It's called a man in the middle attack. From being that man in the middle that is collecting all usernames and passwords as you send it out. Whoever your internet provider is, they are a man in the middle that could be collecting all that information. Well, that's true with McDonald's is my connection, but then McDonald's has a connection to actually the internet. My VPN is also a man in the middle that they could be capturing everything. If I'm getting a VPN service for free, there might be a reason why it's free. If it's free, then you are the product that they're looking for. Now, I don't think all VPNs are necessarily bad, but there are some that are bad and known to be bad. And so there are some better ones than others. And I use Private Internet Access, PIA, Private Internet Access. Would it be illegal? It would be unethical. It'd be immoral. But I don't know that it's necessarily illegal, because they are the ones that are providing this. You've asked them to go get that information for you and give it to you. They do kind of stand in this spot that, here at the bio office, every bit of traffic that comes and goes through a box that I have in a little room in there. As far as our staff here in the office, we've got a piece of paper that says, you have no expectation of privacy. I can see everything you do through our internet connection. And I have the authority to go and check out anything. Now, that's a moral contract we have with the people here in the office. But Comcast, Charter, whoever, has that ability as well. Is it illegal? It probably is. Arguing it in court would probably get them shut down. But that doesn't mean that they can't do it. They certainly can. The technical ability is there. Right.
To monitor a certain amount of information.
Right.
If the FBI comes and they want to do an investigation, they want records. And
right.
So under some places, you're required by law to keep certain parts of information for so long. Mm-hmm.
Yes, the Wi-Fi pineapple thing is illegal. Yes. Now there are use the device itself is not illegal. The way you use it can be illegal. It's usually illegal, but it can also be used for appropriate things. Okay, so VPN, and I'll get some very specific details for you on that in the next session. Let me take a few minutes to go to the end of my notes, and we may come back to something else earlier. But let me encourage you to learn to type. Learn to type. Okay? I know, I'm stepping on toes here, but learning to type, you're not going to do less typing in the future than what you do today. You're just going to do more and more and more of it. You're gonna waste a whole lot less time if you learn to type. Here's something I put together last year, and so let me just read it here. Assuming you only type 1 hour a day, you'll save 2.5 hours in a 5-day work week, by increasing your speed from 30 words per minute to 60 words per minute. Whatever your current speed is, if you double that, you're going to save 2.5 hours of work in a week. That sounds pretty good. That's 10 hours in a month, 120 hours in a year, just by doubling your speed. If your speed is 30, doubling it to 60 is pretty easy. Now, if your speed's 60, it's not likely you're going to double to 120. But if you doubled your typing speed, that's 120 hours saved in a year. Now, would you consider it appropriate for, in your ministry, to take a 3-week vacation every year? Most of us would say, I'd never take that much time off. I wouldn't take a 3-week vacation. But yet you're wasting 3 weeks worth of work. 120 hours. That's 3 40-hour work weeks by not knowing how to type. I would never take a 3-week vacation. But yet, we're wasting that much time. Learn to type and then take the vacation. Why not? You're using the same amount of time. So, yes, it may not be possible for you to double your typing speed, but if you could at least get more efficient at it, you're going to do better. I suspect most of us spend more than an hour a day typing on average, especially if you're doing any kind of sermon prep or whatever. 30 words per minute for a 300-word email would take you 10 minutes to type. If you were typing 60 words per minute, it only takes 5 minutes to type that email. So you're cutting your amount of time on the keyboard in half. If you learn to type properly, then you're able to focus more on what you're writing. You're not having to think, okay, where's the letter S? You can just type your words. You don't have to think about the words. You don't have to constantly be looking at the keyboard. You can think through your fingers. You just type what it is you're thinking if you'll learn to type. You'll have fewer neck and up and down movements. You're just going to save yourself. If you type 70 words per minute or faster, then you probably don't need to work on your typing speed. You're probably fine. But I suspect most of us aren't there. And so work on your typing, not just for the speed's sake, but just so that you don't have to think about it. You can just type, and you can be more focused on what it is you're working on. If your current method prevents you from typing 70 words per minute, if it's physically impossible for you to type 70 words per minute, at the way you're typing now, then your method is probably wrong. because if you do the normal 10-finger typing that they talk about, then you can type that fast. If you spend 10 to 15 minutes a day to learning your new letters, getting started with, if you don't know how to type properly now, then if you just spend 10 or 15 minutes a day, it'll take you less than a month to learn how to type properly. If you'll spend 10 to 15 minutes a day working on getting to 50 words per minute or faster, then you're going to save yourself much, much time in the future. So work on your typing skills. I think that's one of those basic computer skills that we do every day, and yet we don't do anything to improve it. Yet we could. We could, and it would save you much time in the future. There are online games you can play. During Terry's lecture this morning, I tested one of them out to make sure it was still working fine. it's called Type Racer, typeracer.com, and you can race against other people and typing. And it just takes some focus. If you already know how to type, it takes focus on getting faster. If you don't know how to type, then work on the basic skills of learning how to type. Okay, anything along that?
Yeah,
oh yes. I got one I'll tell you privately. Yes, yes. Work on your basic English skills. I'll talk about that in my other lecture. That you've got pastors that have earned doctorate degrees, and you're sending them letters. You shouldn't have a lot of grammatical and spelling mistakes in there. They value their education, and you're asking them to support you. And it could be obvious that you don't value your education. And I realize we all make mistakes. But yes, be aware of what autocorrect is doing to you. Have you heard of the VPN filter thing that's been going on the last 3 weeks or so? FBI sent out a warning, please reset your routers. Did y'all see anything about that? It was on the news maybe 3 weeks or so ago. VPN filter is, okay, you know what your router is. That's the box that's inside your house. You have the cable coming into a modem. So the cable comes from outside. Your provider comes into a modem. That modem usually goes into a router. Now, your router and modem all may be one unit. But that router, Linksys, Cisco, all different brands, D-Link. That router, there was a kind of a virus worm type thing that propagated a few weeks ago into these routers inside your house, which then gave the bad guys abilities to attack other places, or even to monitor your traffic, because all of your network information goes through that box. And it usually goes through that box before it gets encrypted. So that's your connection to the world. Well, it ended up being, I think the last count I heard, which was a little over a week ago, 500,000 routers that are infected with this. And one of the things you do is you unplug it, plug it back in, and it at least kills it for a short time. All of that takes place because people still are using the default username and password on their router. If you have changed the username and password on your router, none of that matters. The FBI is telling you unplug it, plug it back in, reset it, and everything. But if you had changed the username and password to begin with, then that would be a non-issue. I go to people's houses. People will say, well, I need help with my internet connection. It's not working. Well, I sit down and I try admin for username and password into their router. Half the time it works. Or default, that's another one. The other half of the time it works. People aren't changing their username and password. You need to find out what box it is you're using for your internet connection, your router. That's the one that lets you plug in multiple computers. It's the one that distributes your Wi-Fi. Figure out what that box is and change your password on that. You should always, anytime you get a piece of equipment, you should always change the username and password to something that's not the default, because the default means that the bad guys can get into your router and give you problems. I set up a new camera yesterday, and part of the process was give it a username and password. But if you don't want to, admin is the username and password for this camera. Well, that's great. I'm changing it. And you need to change any kind of time you get a consumer piece of equipment that has a username and password, change the password so that it's no longer the default username password combo. This whole VPN filter thing that's going around right now would be non-existent if you change your password. Well, it doesn't affect me. If I got into your house and looked at every bit of traffic that went in and out of your house before it got encrypted, you might think it's not affecting you, but I'm getting a lot of good information. So make sure you change the default username and passwords on devices, particularly your router, because that is your connection to the world. All right, it's time for a break. We'll take a break, and I believe Brother Chris is on schedule next.